Hi there, this is Jill in Minnesota, and you're listening to Most Wanted.
Hello, Sissy.
Hello.
Welcome back to episode 66. I'm Lauren.
And I'm Amanda. 66. Oh,
I know. It's
honey.
It's
not come in the closet. Don't do it.
Oh, God. I was going to say happy end of my favorite month, but we're already distracted.
I know. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Just don't step on my computer.
Okay. So while you're messing with your dog, Hi, little girl. Can I tell you about a new show that I watched this week?
Please.
So I watched, it's on, I think, Hulu. I watched it. It's a show. It's called A Teacher.
And I've heard of this, but never seen it.
Yeah. It's a mini series. I think it's 9 or 10 episodes, but it's pretty quick. I think they're maybe an hour long, but it stars Kate Mara, who I love.
I also love Kate Mara.
What do you know her from? Because
I know her from a lot of things. She was in Everwood. She was in, We Are Marshall. She was in, the first season of that House of Cards.
Okay, I was gonna say, so Kate Mara is best known for, and then I like did a Google and I was like, well, I've never seen that. Well, I've never seen that. Well, I've never seen that.
What is she best known for?
Well, I thought it was gonna be Horror Story, American Horror Story, Murder House. Nope, it was like on like the third page.
Yeah, I was like, I don't think it's that.
And then House of Cards, obviously.
Yeah, she was the one that was sleeping with Kevin Spacey the first season.
Isn't she in the first two seasons, or is the second season she just comes back in flashbacks?
Must just be flashbacks.
Okay. Yeah.
Spoiler alert from years ago, she is killed by Kevin Spacey at the end of the first season.
Okay, because when I looked at it, it said she was in two seasons, and I was like, I'm pretty sure she died, but maybe she died at the beginning of season two was what I thought.
I'm pretty sure it's the last episode of season one, but
no, I think you're right.
I bet there's flashbacks.
Almost
has to be.
Yeah, okay, so that makes way more sense. And then, yeah, basically after halfway through season two, I stopped watching because...
Mm-hmm. I think I made it to season three, and then I was like, I can't do this. But I want to finish it eventually, but now with the Kevin Spacey stuff, I don't
know. Yeah, no, I'm good. Also, so it stars Kate Mara and then Nick Robinson. Do you know who that is?
No.
Okay, so he is in Jurassic World. So, like, the new ones with Chris Pratt. He's the older brother. I think his name is Gray. Doesn't matter. He's one of the kids that... Dallas Howard. No, what the? Her name is Bryce Dallas Howard. So that was my bad.
Oh, Bryce Dallas Howard. Yeah, I was like, you're right. Yeah. It's definitely three names. I'm pretty sure she still has the last name Howard, at least.
Yes.
Before Big. Yeah.
Yeah. So she is the aunt, whatever. And then he's also in Love, Simon. Did you ever see that?
Oh.
It's so good.
I watched Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda. I don't think I ever watched Love, Simon. Unless... Love, Simon is the adaptation of Simon versus Homo Sapiens Agenda.
I have, again, no idea what you're talking about. I have, like, this beautiful, like, Cliff Notes things, and you're just shooting it off to something. I was like,
I'm so sorry. Okay. No, I think you're right. As I was saying it, I was like, oh, I think they renamed, it's based on a book. They renamed it to Love, Simon. Oh,
okay.
Because the book title is very long. Book title is Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda.
Okay.
By Becky Albertalli, I believe.
All of this.
Anyway, I have seen Love, Simon long ago, though, when it first came out.
I suggest you watch it again. It's really good.
Okay.
It also has Ashley Zuckerman in it, who is in the Fear Street trilogy that we are going to watch when we do all of our movie nights eventually.
Yep.
Also, like I said, I highly recommend it, but they're also coming out with a new Fear Street. Hmm. So Fear Street Prom Queen is coming to Netflix sometime. But anyways, I'm talking to you about A Teacher. Are so sidetracked.
Yeah, so sidetracked.
But so the premise of this show is there's a female English teacher and she's like in her 30s and she begins a relationship with her 17-year-old student. So it starts when he's in high school and then it moves on for... I think he's 17 and then it ends when he's 27. So
is it based on anything?
I mean,
Mary Kay Letourneau, perhaps?
I was going to, but Willy Folau was like in eighth grade. Like he wasn't a senior.
Yeah, he was much younger.
So yeah, I also said this is kind of very Mary Kay Letourneau-esque, but like Willy was very young. Gross, where this one, it starts where like they celebrate his 18th birthday together.
Still
and
gross,
yeah, and so when people find out, she's like, he's 18, but it's like, no.
He's currently 18.
Yeah, like you started well before. Anyways, it's done really well. It, you know, it covers grooming, so all of that stuff. It's done so well, and I highly recommend it. Also, 10 out of 10, do recommend.
Okay.
So, since we kind of started with a trigger warning with the grooming stuff, are you ready to go into this week's episode?
I am. Let's do it. I know you've been teasing me about it for a while. I know nothing about this case. So yeah, let's do it. Let's do it.
So in true me fashion, I'm taking us back to the most notorious list. And this week we're heading to South Carolina. Are you ready to play What's My Crime?
Yes.
Today I'm going to be talking about Susan Smith. What do you think she did to be South Carolina's most notorious person?
Ooh, you mentioned grooming. I have a bad feeling about all of this. You might have even told me, and I don't even remember. Something with kids. It's got to be something with kids.
Trigger warnings for this week are murder, suicide, abortion, and grooming a little bit. I don't really get into it, but it's implied.
Oh, no. Okay.
So disclaimer, this story jumps around a lot, but I try to keep it in chronological order. So stop me with any questions.
Okay.
Also, there's a lot of people in the story. So again, stop me with any questions.
Okay. Sounds good.
So I have a lot of background to get through pretty quickly. So let's get going. Susan Lee Vaughn was born September 26, 1971 in Union, South Carolina to Linda and Harry Vaughn. She had two brothers. Her older brother, Michael, was not Harry's son. When Harry and Linda met, Linda was already pregnant. Mm. Susan's parents were known to have a very rough relationship. It was said that her father would get so enraged that he would threaten suicide, but also he threatened to kill Susan's mother.
Ugh.
So this was the house that Susan grew up in for the very early years of her life.
Yikes.
Susan and her brother, Scotty, so her younger brother, were in constant fear of their father and what would happen next in their home. And when Susan was just 3 years old, her brother Michael attempted to die by suicide.
Oh my God. This is so much trauma.
Yeah. Oh, I'm only on page two.
Oh no.
So a lot of people remember Susan as a very sad child, and she would almost disassociate and live in like a dream world at a very young age.
That's horrible.
Susan was extremely close with her father, and when Susan was six, her parents divorced, which affected her dad to the point where he started drinking even more, and he fell into a very deep depression. Mm. On January 15th, 1978, 5 weeks after Harry and Linda's divorce became final, Harry Vaughn attempted to die by suicide.
God. So both the brother and the dad have now attempted, but have not succeeded.
Yes.
Oh, yikes. Okay.
Well, just give me like three more sentences.
Okay.
So the attempt was preceded by an argument between Harry and Linda that escalated and forced Linda to call the police. Okay. When the police officers arrived at Linda's house, they saw Harry strike Linda. Mm. The police report also noted that Harry had broken a window to gain entry into Linda's home.
Oh, yikes.
After the police came to Linda's home, Harry apparently feared that he would hurt someone and pleaded to one of the police officers to take him in so that he could be jailed because he was afraid he would hurt someone.
Okay.
The police did not take him in.
Okay.
Harry attempted suicide by placing a gun between his legs and aiming the gun in his abdomen.
Ah.
Harry then pulled the trigger, mortally wounding himself, but he did not die immediately. He called 911 for assistance and was rushed to the hospital, but emergency surgery could not save his life. He was 37 years old when he died.
Oh my God.
So it sounded
like sitting with the, oh my God.
But he clearly, to me anyways, it seems like he really didn't want to die because he called 911.
Yeah, he probably just wanted to be stopped. Like, the stuff going on in his head, he wanted to stop.
Yeah, I agree. So,
that sucks.
His suicide left a huge void in Susan's life.
Yeah.
Linda did not feel the same about losing Harry. In fact,
Linda... Is Linda a bad guy? Can I say fuck Linda, or is that not what I should be saying?
I don't really care about Linda. No one really cares about Linda.
Okay.
She's... I'd say she's kind of a brat, but...
Okay.
Growing up...
To consider that the father of two of your children just died and you don't care about it, just like, fuck you, man.
Yeah, no, I agree.
At least try.
She... Just wait. Okay. Yeah, like, she... Great. She, to me, she's not really, like, a key player, but she definitely forms her daughter a certain way. Okay. But I think she's kind of a brat.
Okay.
So, Linda was so over it that she got married a few weeks later.
Weeks?
Weeks. Oh, I mean, God. This was the cause of Linda filing for divorce in the first place.
Oh.
But.
Okay.
His death didn't derail. For her. Yeah, yeah, derail anything.
Jeez.
So, Linda married Beverly Russell, who is a wealthy business owner and a local political leader active in the Christian Coalition and a member of a well-known union family.
I'm assuming Beverly is a man because yes. South yep. Carolina at this time. Okay.
Yep. I call him Bev, I think, throughout the rest of this.
Okay.
So with the new father figure in her life, a lot has changed for Susan.
Mm-hmm.
Susan moved into a bigger home, mm-hmm. into a nicer part of town, and it was a total lifestyle change.
Okay.
But Susan still continued to struggle with losing her dad.
Yeah.
She was going into her teen years, and with that, she sought out approval from a father figure, Bev.
Mm.
She desperately wanted his attention and approval. And as she got older, she started to compete with her mom for the attention of her stepfather.
Oh, no.
So there is a story that says when Susan was 16, she crawled into Bev's lap and fell asleep.
16? That's so gross.
When she woke up, he was molesting her.
Of course he was. Like, that. Sorry, I shouldn't say it that way, but like 16 in his lap for him to allow that?
Well, okay, so to me, it seems like she's like literally sitting on his lap, like curled up in a ball. I think what actually happens is she fell asleep on the couch with her head in his lap, which I don't think that makes it any better, but a little bit.
That does not make it a ton better.
No. So I think like she was, yeah, head in his lap, fell asleep. I think someone was staying with them. So she was sleeping on the couch because someone was in her room.
Okay. But, whatever.
Yeah.
Gross.
Yep. So she continued to pretend to be asleep until that was over.
Oh.
In another instance, Susan reported a different molestation to her guidance counselor. Mm. Obviously, the guidance counselor had to report it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Linda and Beverly Russell separated later that year after family court released a record that showed Beverly admitted to the molestation.
Ah! Ah! Okay. Gross, Beverly.
Beverly was not prosecuted. Because Susan and her mother did not press charges. Mm. And later in life, Susan said she was a willing participant. Mm. Also, Linda and Bev get back together. And they stayed together for basically all of this.
Ugh.
So as a child, Susan had been through some things. But throughout her...
Don't say.
I know. When I wrote that, I was like, well, that's putting it lightly.
Understatement of the year.
But throughout her elementary, junior, and high school years, Susan excelled. While she was in high school, she was a member of the Beta Club, which is, I think, everyone with a B plus average or better.
Okay.
You can be in this club. She was also a member of the Math, Spanish, and Red Cross Club. Wow. She volunteered at Union's annual Special Olympics, and she worked with the elderly.
Okay.
Susan was named president of the Junior Civitan Club, which is... a high school club that performs volunteer work in the community. I didn't know what a civitan club was.
I don't either, but okay, cool.
And
big into volunteer work.
Yeah. And from 1986 to 1988, Susan and her best friend volunteered as candy stripers at Wallace Thompson Hospital in Union.
Okay.
So seems like despite most everything that happened, she was still doing well.
Yeah, sounds like it. But that's probably a lot of repression of what was happening to her, right?
Ding, ding, ding.
Okay, great.
In the summer of 1988, between her junior and senior year of high school, mm-hmm. Susan began working at the Winn-Dixie supermarket in Union. Mm. Susan's first job at the market was a cashier, but within 6 months, she was promoted to head cashier, and later she was promoted again to the market's bookkeeper.
In high school?
Mm-hmm.
She was a bookkeeper in high school?
Okay. I guess so.
Okay.
At the beginning of her senior year of high school, Susan began to secretly date one of her coworkers from the Winn-Dixie.
Was he much older than her?
An older married man.
Hmm. Gross.
Shortly after her relationship with this older married coworker began, Susan became pregnant and had an abortion.
Okay.
At the same time that this relationship was occurring, Susan was also dating a different coworker.
So she didn't know whose baby it was?
After the abortion, the older married coworker found out about the other relationship, and he ended his relationship with Susan. Because he can sleep with whoever the fuck he wants, but she can't.
That makes sense to me, obviously. Women don't have choices, Lauren.
I'm aware. But Susan became deeply depressed after this breakup.
Yeah.
And in early of November 1988, Susan attempted to die by suicide by taking an overdose of aspirin and Tylenol.
Okay.
Susan was admitted to Spartanburg Regional Medical Center on November 7th, 1988, and remained in the hospital for 1 week.
Good old Spartanburg.
Do you know Spartanburg?
I do, actually. I've been there.
Oh, okay. I was like, what?
I wasn't sure where in South Carolina Union was, but then, okay, now I'm oriented if she went to Spartanburg. It's inland. It's inland South Carolina. It's not coastal South Carolina.
Oh, okay. That actually makes a lot more sense. Thank you.
Yep.
So during her hospitalization, Susan's doctors discovered that this was not Susan's first suicide attempt. Oh, no. When Susan was 13 years old, she had taken a similar overdose of aspirin. To Susan's suicide attempt, Susan became friendly with David Smith, who was a stock clerk at the Winn-Dixie. So now this is the third gentleman.
At the Winn-Dixie.
No, her and David are like a year apart.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
But she's just with all the coworkers, is what you're saying.
They're only friends at this point.
Mm.
But Susan and David were dating other people, but remained friendly. And when Susan returned back to work after her month-long recovery, David broke up with his girlfriend and began pursuing a relationship with Susan. Mm-hmm. So now we're going to talk about David a little bit.
Yes. Tell me about David.
David Smith was born July 27, 1970 to Barbara and Charles Smith. Charles was a Navy veteran who served 2 tours in Vietnam. Barbara was a devout Jehovah's Witness who sheltered David from many outside influences during his childhood.
Mm, okay.
Which translated to her being very strict, and David was not a fan.
Yeah, that's not always the best way to raise children, just because they rebel badly.
Yeah, but there was more stuff about it, but it didn't really seem pertinent to the story.
Yeah, that's fine.
So, during the summer of 1990... David and Susan began to date. Was it overlapping with his other girlfriend? Yes. But
David.
But that's because David viewed his relationship with Susan as casual, obviously.
Oh, gross. I was trying to, by the way, I was trying to do a Schitt's Creek impersonation.
I know. Well. Ew, David.
Ew,
I know.
David.
So until about a year into casually dating, Susan found out she was pregnant. David was
super casual there, David.
David was then forced to tell his fiance about Susan.
He proposed to this woman while he was casually also dating Susan. Casually.
Very casually. So
very casual.
I don't know why you're freaking out. He was only sleeping with Susan.
It's just like my casual is different from David's casual.
They were only sleeping together. Relax.
Right. Without protection, clearly, because she got pregnant.
Well, would it surprise you that his fiance promptly ended their relationship?
No, that doesn't surprise me at all.
So, David and Susan decided to get married, and it seemed that Susan finding out she was pregnant at such a young age put a stop to some goals that she had for herself, like college.
That's the second time she found out she was pregnant at a young age.
Right, but... the first one, she had an abortion. It sounded like abortion was totally off the table. And I think that goes into David's upbringing.
That makes sense. Okay.
Hence the marriage then.
And he wasn't already married.
Correct. Correct.
Like the other man. Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
So So getting pregnant at such a young age, she had a future in mind that was derailed for the time being. Mm-hmm. In their own ways, Susan and David were emotionally needy people who found comfort in each other at the beginning of their relationship. Mm-hmm. David and Susan fulfilled what the other needed emotionally. However, their relationship was filled with many stresses and strains. Mm. Susan's mother and stepfather were not pleased by the news of Susan's pregnancy and marriage. Linda was disappointed that David did not have a college education and was not from the same economic background as Susan.
What? Linda? Susan wasn't from that background either.
I'm telling you, Linda's a brat. Like, she doesn't... She's just... Linda. I know. So, I have to take you on just another little side story.
Love it.
On March 4th, 1991, David's older brother, Danny... died when he was 22 years old from complications from Crohn's disease.
Oh, bummer.
After a surgery, Danny developed a bacterial infection. What?
He and Jerry can hang out.
I know. Him and Jer Bear. I know.
Yeah, him and Jer Bear.
So, Danny developed a bacterial infection, and in his already weakened condition, his body wasn't strong enough to fight the infection. That's bad. 11 days later, on March 15th, 1991, Susan and David wed at the United Methodist Church in Bogansville.
11 days after his brother died, they got married?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's nothing fucked up with these families.
Yeah, ask me what I would be doing 11 days after you died, if you died.
Not getting fucking married. No, I can tell you that.
Probably still be in bed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, what the hell? Okay.
So Susan was 19 and 2 months pregnant. David was 20. Even though David's family was dealing with the death of Danny, Susan's mother, Linda, insisted that the wedding go forward as scheduled. See,
Linda
was concerned that Susan's pregnancy would begin to show before the wedding could take place.
She was 2 months pregnant.
Chop, chop.
It's not going to show.
Chop, chop.
Ugh.
In May of 1991, 2 months after Susan and David's wedding, David's father attempted to die by suicide.
Oh my God.
Susan found him at his home on the floor. David's father had taken an overdose of pills. From the strain of Danny's death and David's father's attempted suicide, David's parents' marriage fell apart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
After his suicide attempt, David's father was hospitalized and treated for depression. And I only bring this up because while he was in the hospital for this, I believe he ended up meeting his second wife. I don't know if she was a nurse or whatever, but he ended up meeting her.
These people move on, and they move on fast.
I don't know how long he was in the hospital, though. Like, I don't have that information.
Fair. That's fair. It was 2 days.
Okay, so back to the main story. I just needed to give you a little bit of background.
Yeah, this is nuts. Like, the trauma in all of these people's lives.
It's insane.
Yeah. Wow.
So Susan worked at the Winn-Dixie up until she went into labor, and Michael Daniel Smith was born October 10th, 1991.
Okay. So wait, I just have this vision in my head of like a 9.5 month pregnant Susan going into labor at the Winn-Dixie, then being like, I guess I need to take some time off.
That's kind of what I pictured too, but...
Yikes. Okay.
Yeah. So... Even early in the marriage, David and Susan felt a great deal of tension. Remember, they're 19 and 20, so duh. But
and
I'm
they
going
have a baby immediately too.
Right. Well, and I'm going to give you a list of some other reasons.
Oh, great.
So young couples often found themselves with demands and responsibilities that exceeded their expectations of married life.
Yeah.
One of the great areas that caused tension between David and Susan was, can you guess, Amanda?
Money.
Yeah, money. I was like, she's going to guess one of two things. I hope she guesses money, because it is money.
Money. Absolutely money.
According to David, Susan was always interested in material things. Susan.
She's 19.
Material, baby.
And she was raised in a higher class of living, whatever the fuck Linda said.
Yeah. Susan was worried about paying the bills and often asked her mother for loans.
But this went over well.
This angered David because David and Susan earned a fairly good income for being as young as they were to have a kid.
Yeah.
Another area of tension in Susan and David's marriage was Linda and David's relationship. Linda and David did not get along well.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they were like sleeping together. I was like,
I know. I realized after I said it, I was like, I got to speed this up. I'm sorry.
You're watching my face be like, ew, David.
No, no, no. They did not like each other.
Okay.
Linda was very controlling and would often visit the house without calling first.
Oh, I don't like that.
Linda often offered unsolicited advice and opinions about how David and Susan were raising Michael and how to deal with problems in their marriage. And according to David, Susan almost always followed what Linda said.
Oh, that's not good.
Another strain was the fact that Susan and David both still worked at the Winn-Dixie. And at this point, David was Susan's boss.
Oh, no.
I know.
Oh, no.
So the fourth problem with David and Susan's marriage was their extramarital affairs.
Oh, so my EO David was actually kind of fine, just not with Linda.
Just not with Linda, yes.
Okay.
By their third wedding anniversary, David and Susan had separated several times.
Oh, wow.
During their first separation in March of 1992, shortly after their one-year wedding anniversary, Susan rekindled a relationship with a former boyfriend at Winn-Dixie. And this pissed off David.
Yeah, they're all working there.
Correct.
Susan, at least pick a different grocery store. The next grocery store.
What's
down
it called?
The street.
Like, don't shit where you eat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, knock it off. But,
stop it. Literally, there's food there. Don't shit there.
Yeah. Well, anyways. So, during another separation in the summer of 1992. So, the first one is in March of 1992. This is the summer of 1992.
And they've gotten back together and are separated a second time?
Correct.
Oh my gosh.
Susan and Michael went to go live with Linda and Bev. So they're no longer living together.
Great. She's going back to another guy that she slept with.
So David and Susan tried to mend their relationship. And throughout 1992, David and Susan's relationship seesawed back and forth. Susan became pregnant in November of 1992.
Who was the dad?
David. Okay. By all accounts, it's David.
Okay.
Yeah. In December, David and Susan tried again to live under the same roof. And in the winter of 1993, David and Susan bought a small ranch-style house. Hmm. Bev and Linda provided the down payment for the home.
I was going to ask, like, okay, where'd they get that money? Sure, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Susan's second pregnancy was not as happy of an experience as the first one with Michael. David remembers that Susan complained nonstop about being fat and ugly.
Oh, man.
Slowly, Susan began to shut David out of her life completely. She complained about the physical aspects of their relationship and stopped sharing anecdotes about Michael with David. And because of this, David became lonely and wanted someone to talk to.
Oh, no. David.
In June 1993... David began a relationship with a cashier at Winn-Dixie.
You two need to stop it.
It's so not funny. And
work sometimes. Like, what are you doing?
I have read through this script probably 15 times. Not once did I put together that they literally can't leave this grocery store.
It's almost as if they're only ever in this grocery store. Their world is their ranch style home and their grocery store.
I know. Oh, we're laughing because it gets bad now. Laugh all you can, people.
Oh, no. Okay.
And because of this, employees at the Winn-Dixie remember incidents when Susan would visit David at work and would scream at him when she saw him even talking to other women. Not just this woman, just women in general.
So was she not working there anymore? She's visiting him at work.
She's... still is working there, but I'm assuming like on off days she would go in
and okay.
check in on him.
Okay. God, gross. Yeah.
But put all of this aside, all the chaos and the turmoil, Susan and David's second son was born August 5th, 1993.
Okay.
After Alexander Tyler Smith's birth, Susan and David put aside their differences for a short time in order to settle their new baby at home.
Mm.
But within 3 weeks of Alex's birth, Susan and David decided their relationship was over, and David moved out.
Oh, man.
Although their marriage was terrible and headed for divorce, Susan and David were devoted parents and adored their children.
I guess that's...
When Susan went back to work after maternity leave, she decided not to go back to Winn-Dixie. Working with David didn't seem like a good idea to Susan. Plus, she didn't want to see David's new girlfriend who still worked there.
Okay, so you waited until you were getting divorced to decide you don't want to work for your husband anymore?
I guess so.
I would have decided that earlier, but, you know, that's just...
Same. I couldn't even... I would change grocery stores. Like, I could never go back.
There's got to be other Winn-Dixies.
There has to be. Well, there doesn't have to be, but I'm assuming there's something.
There's got to be something. Yeah.
Gosh. So Susan got a job as a bookkeeper at Conso Products.
Okay.
She eventually became the assistant to the executive secretary for J. Carey Finley, the president and CEO of Conso.
Okay.
Susan really enjoyed working for Conso. She was exposed to an expensive lifestyle, which was foreign to her, even though I'm assuming that like Bev was like higher middle class and this is like,
this was like
top tier.
Yeah, got it. Okay.
Yeah. But Susan also liked Conso for another reason. Tom Finley.
I was going to say a bunch of men that she can sleep with because she loves sleeping with people she works with.
Hey, now. We haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, also, we both met our partners at work.
Oh, shit. Yeah, we did. Oh, yeah. Anyways, we're just going to move
fine.
On.
Yeah, everything's fine.
Everything's fine. Don't ever bring that realization to me in the middle of a Susan Smith story. Good God. So Tom was one of J. Carey Finley's sons. Tom was 27 and was the head of the graphic arts department at Conso.
Okay.
He was also very popular with young women in the area. Mm-hmm. He was hot, rich, and single.
Ooh. At least he was married. I'm like,
I know. I know. In the office, the secretaries called Tom the catch, and Susan thought she had him hooked.
Gross. The secretaries were calling him the catch?
Mm-hmm.
That's so gross.
I know.
Okay.
So during Susan and David's latest separation in January of 1994, Tom and Susan began dating for several months. Mm-hmm. During the early summer of 1994, Susan and David tried one final time to make their marriage work.
They did?
I don't know... I mean,
what
she no longer
to
works
the girlfriend?
There. Both Susan and David broke up with their current partners to give it one last try.
Okay, sorry, I missed that part.
Nope, I hadn't gotten there just yet.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. But ultimately, by the end of July of 1994, Susan told David that she wanted a divorce.
I think it's a little interesting that, like, okay, they started trying and to get back together or whatever in summer, but they're already done by the end of July. Like, how long were these attempts?
Like, week 6 weeks, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe 6 weeks.
Okay.
Valiant so David truly seemed,
to all.
I know. So David truly seemed like he wanted to make it work because he thought that their two sons needed their mother and their father together. I'm assuming that goes back to how he was raised.
Yeah, probably.
It's fine. I know a lot of people feel that way, but sometimes it's just not going to work.
No, I mean, I've heard enough stories where, like, the kids are so aware when the parents aren't getting along, even if they're trying to stay together for the kids. Like, it's not healthy for anybody. I understand why people think it is, but it's not. Just get divorced.
Just get divorced. Yeah. No, I agree. So at the beginning of September of 1994, Susan finally felt like her life was settling down. She and David had an amicable relationship centered around taking care of their sons. Mm-hmm. Susan was beginning to believe that her dream of love and stability might finally come true with Tom Finley, who she was dating again. However, Tom felt differently, and he actually ended their relationship shortly after because he felt that Susan was too possessive and needy.
He's a playboy, right?
Yeah.
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 He's not going to want a lady with two young kids.
So, David and Susan are officially heading towards divorce, but a few days before that was finalized, Susan received a Dear John letter from Tom, which sent Susan into an absolute spiral.
He broke up with her via letter?
Mm-hmm. Tom wrote in the letter he was breaking off their relationship because he, quote, did not want the responsibility of children.
Oh, no. Okay. That's what I was afraid was going to happen. And I even said it out loud. And I'm, oh, no.
Amanda, do you know what a Dear John letter is?
I didn't know that you could use them in other contexts. I thought that it was a military thing. But yeah, it's a breakup letter. Like,
yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's, I mean, there's probably more to it than that, but it's a breakup letter.
According to Wikipedia, it's a letter written to a man by his wife or romantic partner to inform him that their relationship is over, usually because his partner has found another lover. So yeah, it sounds like it's very military based.
Yeah, because people would be off.
Anyone can write a breakup letter.
Yeah, yeah. Cowardly to do it in a letter when you're working at the same company, Tom.
Well, okay. I'm just gonna
keep going
right along.
I hope I don't regret saying these things.
Susan was super Susan was super pissed about this letter from Tom. Yeah. So she went to his family cottage, which she had been to with him a few times, to try to get him back.
Oh boy.
Susan tried to gain Tom's sympathy and affection back by telling him about her sexual relationship with Bev Russell, her current stepfather. But this only seemed to shock Tom. Relationship rekindling denied.
What? Why did you
Traumatized. Take me back? I don't know.
I was assaulted by my stepfather when I was 16 while I pretended to sleep. Please love me.
Yeah, do you think that would work on you?
No. I'd be like, you need therapy. Yeah. How can I help you find some therapy? No, I'm not going to sleep with you anymore.
Or you are just confirming what...
Yeah.
Like, I already... You're
so
making
much
it worse.
Baggage and trauma in her past that, like, there's basically nothing that she could say to him that would probably not make it worse for him. Like, he probably lived the high life his entire
life. No, but she is going to... Oh, she's gonna try, though.
Oh, boy.
I think this is gonna be a good time for us to take an ad break, though.
Okay. Sure. That sounds great.
Have you ever had one of those days where you really want to unwind with a fruity cocktail, but you don't want to have a drink? This used to happen to me a lot in the evenings. I was always a bit of a lightweight, and when I had to be productive in the evenings, it was a no alcohol rule for me. These are the perfect nights for Moment Botanical Water, which uses natural adaptogens for their calming properties to reduce your cortisol levels and activate your alpha brainwaves. What does that mean? It means not only is this water delicious, but it can also help you manage stress, enhance your brain function and creativity, and improve your sleep quality. There's also no added sugar and no caffeine, so you can unwind and get creative while drinking Moment. Visit drinkmoment.com and use promo code MOSTWANTEDAMANDA at checkout for 15% off.
Okay. So I saw this segment named The Big Lie. So I'm also calling this segment The Big Lie.
The Big Lie. Okay.
In the fall of 1994, Susan was busy. She was working full time. She went to school part time. She had toddlers to take care of. And she was also playing the field pretty heavily.
Okay. What was she going to school for? Do you know?
Fuck, I did know. I had it written down. Now I don't remember. Nursing, maybe?
That's fine. I was just curious, like, how some subjects would take more effort than others. You know,
I want to say nursing. I could be totally wrong.
Be high effort, I would think.
Yeah, but also she's playing the field, so.
Right, playing the field. I know that was what I was supposed to take from that.
But you're like, school, huh? What kind of school?
What can I relate to in this sentence?
Exactly. Susan was still involved with some key players from her past.
Oh boy.
Tom Finley, David Smith, and Bev Russell.
Is she sleeping with all of them still?
She is.
Oh, okay.
So during this time, Susan was growing anxious when she was alone, and it made her severely depressed.
Oh, yikes. Okay.
So Tuesday, October 25th, 1994, started like any other day. She got ready for work, dropped her kids off at daycare, and went to work. During lunch that day, Susan and some other people from Conso went to lunch, Tom being one of them.
Okay.
At 1:30 in the afternoon, Susan asked her supervisor if she could leave work early. Her supervisor, Sandy, asked her what was wrong, and Susan replied, quote, "I'm in love with someone who doesn't love me." And when Sandy asked who she was talking about, Susan replied, "Tom Finley. But it can never work because of my children."
Okay. Would you be that forthcoming with your boss if you wanted to leave work early?
No.
I'm kind of friends with my boss, so I might, but like probably still not. Not like that.
Susan did not go home, however. Instead, it is said that she just sat at her desk. At around 2:30 p.m., Susan called Tom in his office and asked if they could speak outside. Susan told Tom that David was threatening to expose her and make some embarrassing information about her public in their divorce proceedings. Tom asked her to explain, and Susan told him that David would accuse her of cheating the IRS and also of having an affair with his father, Tom's father, the CEO of the company that they work for.
Is that true? Did she do that? It wouldn't surprise me, honestly.
It's not, I couldn't find anywhere that's confirmed that happened, but okay. It is brought up quite a few times later.
Interesting. So, okay. So say it wasn't true. Just okay. Spitball here. What was she trying to do?
Okay.
By telling Tom this?
So give me like
Go.
Half a page.
Yep. Go.
So after recovering from the shock of hearing about this alleged affair, Tom told Susan that their friendship would remain intact, but their intimate relationship would have to stop forever. At 4:30 p.m., Susan sought out Tom again. Susan attempted to return a sweatshirt that she had borrowed from Tom and in the past, but Tom refused to accept it back. So it's like his alma mater sweatshirt.
Okay. Well, and she's clearly trying to find an excuse to see him.
Right.
Like, try to convince him again.
It makes the letter make more sense.
Yes. The reasoning, the things that she decides to tell him to be like, this will definitely win him back, are bizarre.
Yes. Yes. So, after collecting her sons from daycare that day, Susan headed to Hickory Nuts, which was a bar that the coworkers seemed to frequent.
Hickory Nuts?
It's brought up a couple more times, so yeah.
Hickory Nuts.
Yeah. So while she was driving there, she spotted Sue Brown, the marketing manager at Conso. Both Sue and Susan pulled into the Hickory Nuts parking lot.
Are Susan's kids still in the car?
Yeah. Susan talked to Sue and convinced her to go with her back to work so that she could apologize to Tom for lying to him about sleeping with his dad. She admitted that she made it up just to see Tom's reaction.
Why?
Oh.
Okay.
Again, the things she chooses to tell him to try to win him back are bizarre.
Bizarre.
So the women arrived together at Conso around 5:30 that evening. Tom was not happy to see Susan and quickly got her out of his office.
I bet he did.
So she only brought Sue with her so that when she went in to talk to him, Sue could watch her kids.
Susan.
I realize I cut that from the script and it's kind of important to tell them why she brought someone else.
Sometimes when you're doing something like that, you want a witness. So I was kind of just going to go with it, but that makes it almost worse that she was just like, I need you to watch my kids while I try to get my boyfriend back.
So back in the car, Susan told Sue that she was really upset and that she may just end it. Susan brought Sue Brown back to Hickory Nuts and then she drove home. Later in the evening, Sue Brown was eating dinner at Hickory Nuts with several friends, including Tom. Mm. During the meal, a waiter brought a cordless phone to Sue. Susan was on the other end and was calling to ask if Tom had asked about her. And Sue told Susan he had not.
Susan.
She's spiraling.
Oh, yes. Oh, no.
At 8 p.m., Susan dressed her sons, placed them in their car seats, in her car and began driving around Union. Around 9 p.m., Shirley McLeod was relaxing in her living room, located close to John D. Long Lake. Shirley had just finished reading the paper when she heard a wailing sound coming from her front porch. Shirley switched on the porch light and saw a young woman sobbing hysterically on her front porch. The young woman cried, "Please help me. He's got my kids. He's got my car." Shirley brought Susan Smith into her house, and Susan explained, "A black man has my kids and my car."
Oh, no. Now you're being racist. Okay.
Shirley's son then called 911.
Okay.
Once Susan had calmed down, Shirley asked Susan to tell her what had happened. So Susan told her, "I was stopped at a red light on Monarch Mills, and a black man jumped in and told me to drive."
Mm.
I asked him, "Why are you doing this?" And he said, "Shut up and drive or I'll kill you."
This seems like one of those fake stories. I'm assuming it's a fake story.
Susan continued that at the abductor's directions, she drove northeast of Union for about 4 miles until he made her stop. Quote, "He told me to get out. He made me stop in the middle of the road. Nobody was coming, not a single car. I asked him, 'Why can't I take my kids?'" Susan then told Shirley that the man said, "I don't have time." Susan then said that the man pushed her out of her car while he was pointing the gun at her. Susan continued that when he finally got me out, he said, "Don't worry, I'm not going to hurt your kids." Susan described that she laid on the ground as the man drove away and as both of her sons cried out for their mother. After a while, Susan wasn't sure how long. She began to run and only stopped when she reached Shirley McLeod's porch. Susan then asked if she could call her mother. When Susan was unable to reach her mother, she called her stepfather, and then she called David. By the time Susan reached David on the phone, the Union County Sheriff, Howard Wells, was at the McLeod's home and was directing a search for the Smith children.
I don't know how I feel about any of this. Okay, keep going.
Wells asked Susan to repeat her story, although he had heard it already from the 911 dispatcher and from Shirley McLeod. Susan also described the clothes that her sons were wearing. After Susan finished, Wells realized that the carjacking was not going to be solved quickly, so he needed to reach out to extra help to have all the resources necessary to find the Smith children.
Okay.
Wells called Chief Robert Stewart, the head of South Carolina's Law Enforcement Division, also known as SLED, so I call them SLED.
SLED, yes. SLED is in the Alec Murdoch case.
That's in South Carolina?
It is.
Oh, I thought it was in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Nope, that's what I'm talking about. Like, South Carolina, I'm surprised this is most...
Well, this list was before any of the Alex Murdaugh stuff happened.
Good point. Sorry. Continue.
So maybe we'll cover that and there'll be a new updated list. But when I pulled this list back in 2022.
Yeah, that his trial hadn't happened yet. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Sorry. No worries.
So called SLED for additional assistance. Union County Sheriff's deputies continued to search for the Smith children and for Susan's Mazda. Around midnight, Sheriff Wells suggested that Susan and her family find a different meeting place, because at the time, they were also at the McLeod's house.
What?
Yeah. Could you imagine, like, some lady just shows up at your door at 9?
And just take over your house?
Yeah.
No. I'd be like, okay, I'm happy to help you. Go somewhere else. I'm tired.
So, then Susan offered her mother's home. So, Susan, David, Bev, Linda, and assorted friends and family left the McLeod's house for the Russell home at midnight.
What?
Yeah.
Why did she beckon them all to some stranger's house instead of going like to the police station or to their own home or something?
She never, I thought it was weird. She never called 911. Obviously, Shirley's son did, but like.
She could have earlier than that though. Like she could have, that could have been the first thing she asked for is like, I need to call 911. I have a bad feeling about all this, so continue.
Okay. So Susan rode with David to the Russell's home, and Susan told David that Tom might come and see her and that she didn't want David to get angry. David
Why
found
would she think that?
David found Susan's statement incredible in light of the fact that their sons were missing.
Well, and she knows that he's not going to... I would hope that she would think he was not going to come.
Like, she does not know he's not going to come.
God, okay. Yikes.
It appeared to David that Susan was more worried that he'd be upset if her boyfriend came to visit rather than worrying about finding her sons.
Boyfriend in quotes.
I don't think David knows that they've broken up.
Well, because if Susan is not admitting to herself that it's over, there's no way David would know.
Correct. So a police sketch artist met with Susan and, using the description she provided, composed a sketch of a black man around 40 years of age wearing a dark knit cap, a dark shirt, jeans, and a plaid jacket. Mm. So throughout October 26, 1994, Union County Sheriff deputies and sled agents searched the area around John D. Long Lake. Mm-hmm. Later in the afternoon of October 26, another organization became involved in the search for Michael and Alex Smith, the Adam Walsh Center.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So I'm going to take you on a little history lesson.
Yep.
So in 1981, 6-year-old Adam Walsh was abducted from a Florida shopping mall and later found brutally murdered. Mm-hmm. When Adam first disappeared, his parents, John and Reve Walsh, R-E-V-E, but the E, last E has the little line over it.
I would assume it's Reve. I don't actually know if I've ever heard it said.
To their disbelief, there was no coordinated effort among law enforcement to search for Adam on a state or national level and no organization to help them in their desperation. Mm. In 1981, in response to this tragedy, the Walshes established Adam Walsh Outreach Center for Missing Children in Florida, mm-hmm, to serve as a national resource for other families with missing children.
That was started in 1981?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't realize it was that long ago. I know it was the 80s. I thought it was late 80s. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'll get there in a second.
Yeah, okay.
So as the national government grew, Congress enacted the Missing Children's Act of 1982, which enabled the entry of missing children's information into the FBI's National Crime Information Center database, also known as NCIC. You call it something? No, or is it just
It's NCIC.
Okay. Yeah. So former President Ronald Reagan officially opened the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, NCMEC. Thank you. I was going to say one of them said.
NCMEC.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. So that was in 1984. And in 1990, the Adam Walsh Outreach Center merged with NCMEC.
Got it. Okay. That makes more sense.
Yeah. I was going to say it is a little bit later, but it was originally established in
1981. I thought that I'm probably getting it confused with Jacob Wetterling. I thought Adam Walsh was also late 80s. Clearly it wasn't.
Yeah.
I think Jacob Wetterling was 89.
So that was just the Adam Walsh history lesson. So back to the story.
Yep.
Margaret Fearson, executive director of the South Carolina chapter of the Adam Walsh Center, spoke to Susan's sister-in-law and offered the center's assistance to Susan and David Smith. Later the same day, Bev Russell called Margaret back and provided directions to his home. The house quickly filled with more relatives, friends, and neighbors. And Susan never spent a moment alone. In her parents' home, her friends and family comforted Susan and provided the affectionate nurturing Susan had so badly desired. This was in sharp contrast to the isolation and loneliness she recently felt.
Oh, so she's getting the attention she wants. Okay.
Tom Finley called Susan and expressed his sympathies about Michael and Alex.
He did call?
Susan shifted the topic of conversation away from her missing children and to her relationship with him.
Oh my God. Tom's probably like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Tom told Susan not to worry about their relationship and to concentrate on her children. This telephone call would be the only one that Susan would ever receive from Tom. And Tom never visited Susan.
Okay. He was done.
He was done. I mean, of course he cared enough to say, oh my God, I'm so sorry about your children. But
he's not going to be like, thank God those pesky kids are no longer in your life.
Right. When Sue Brown came to visit, Susan Smith asked when Tom was planning on visiting her.
Ugh. Gross.
Margaret Fearson and Charlotte Foster arrived at the Russell home on the afternoon of October 26th.
Okay.
Instead of talking to Susan and David alone, the woman met with Susan, David, Bev, Linda, and Scotty. Scotty's Susan's younger brother. Yep.
Okay. Yeah.
Margaret explained that she and Charlotte could act as the family's liaison to the news media and could arrange and schedule interviews and broadcast pictures of the missing boys and information about the crime.
Okay.
That's nice. About 40.
I said, that's nice of them.
Oh, yeah. Because, yeah, you when your kids are missing, you have to get that information out quick.
Oh, yeah. 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 It's what is there's a stat that like if you don't find a kid in like 24 or 48 hours, the chances just exponentially tank.
Yes.
Of finding them alive. Yeah.
After about 40 minutes, Susan and David excused themselves from the conversation and drove to the sheriff's office for interviews. Mm. When they got there, Sheriff Wells questioned Susan in his office. Margaret and SLED investigator Eddie Harris spoke with David about making a plea for the safe return of his sons to the news.
Yeah.
Margaret and investigator Harris believed that a national televised appeal for the children's return would be instrumental in solving the boys' disappearance. Mm. David was nervous, but agreed that it was important to do anything that would return his sons.
Yeah.
At first, the carjacking was covered by the local paper and local radio stations, but interest in the story quickly grew, and the national networks were soon covering the story.
Because it sounds like it's so such a sensational story, and I just have this bad feeling that it's not. I truly know nothing about this case.
David, with Susan by his side, stood on the steps of the Union County Sheriff's Department and made the following statement. To whoever has our boys, we ask that you please don't hurt them and bring them back. We love them very much. I plead to the guy, please return our children to us safe and unharmed. Everywhere I look, I see their toys, pictures. Oh, they are both wonderful children. I don't know how else to put it, and I can't imagine my life without them.
Oh my God.
After he finished, David, along with Susan, returned to the sheriff's office. Susan was questioned by both investigators from the Union County Sheriff's Office and agents from SLED for about 6 hours.
Wow.
Susan was asked on a number of occasions to repeat the details of her story.
Oh, she's... So, is it either she's changing her story or is it that it's so rehearsed that they don't believe her anymore?
They want to make sure that they're getting all the facts correct. Mm-hmm. She does change it in a little bit, but she hasn't changed it yet.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So at the end of the day, Sheriff Wells called David A. Caldwell, who's the director of Forensic Science Laboratory and blah, blah, blah in Columbia. Anyways, they called him to also interview Susan. So like I said, there's so many fucking people in the story.
Yeah, there's so many people in the story. Okay.
I'm very sorry. So 2 days after the carjacking on Thursday, October 27th, 1994, both David and Susan submitted to polygraph tests administrated by the FBI.
Okay.
Administered?
It's probably administered. Supposed to be administered, yeah.
I'm so sorry. Administered by the FBI. I was like, that's not right.
I was just going to go with it.
Sorry. Susan and David each read and signed a form advising them of their Miranda rights. David's tests showed that he
really.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So David's tests showed that he knew nothing about the disappearance of his sons.
Yep.
Susan's test showed that her greatest level of deception was when she was asked the question, "Do you know where your children are?"
Because she's a lying liar who lies.
After each time Susan was interviewed, she was given a polygraph test moving forward.
Because they don't believe her anymore.
Susan was asked many times to tell the story from the beginning, from when she had woken up that day. Mm-hmm. Susan told Agent Caldwell that she called her mother after she came home from work and asked if she could come visit her later in the evening. Susan's mother told her that she had other plans and would not be home. So Susan made dinner for her sons, but they were fussy and did not want to eat. David called Susan during that time, and during the time she was preparing the dinner, and later told the police that he could hear his sons in the background and they did seem fussy. So he is confirming that the kids were
did the
being
mom
kids.
Confirm
I don't know.
That did the mom confirm that
yep.
Susan actually called her?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Susan told Caldwell that at 7:30 PM, Michael told her he wanted to go to Walmart.
How old is Michael again? Like
3. Caldwell questioned Susan about this, and Susan admitted that she actually suggested going to Walmart.
And this is where I say Michael being like Walmart.
So this is where I remind you, Michael is 3 years old. Yeah. Alex is 14 months old.
Oh, they're so little.
Susan told Caldwell that she drove to Foster Park and stayed until 8:40 PM, but she did not get out of her car. Susan then claimed she returned to the Walmart parking lot because of the bright lights so that she could search for Alex's bottle that he had dropped on the floor of the car, which I can totally see that happening.
I can see that. Yeah, that's actually legit.
So Susan told Caldwell that Michael then suggested visiting Mitchell Sinclair, who is the fiance of her best friend. No. But then she changed her answer when Caldwell questioned her further about it.
No. What?
Agent Caldwell told Susan that investigators had spoken to Mitchell, and he told them that he was not expecting her, and that he wasn't even home. Mm. Like, before cell phones, remember? Like, this landline shit. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Caldwell also told Susan that investigators had visited the Walmart and had spoken to many people who were working or were shopping at the store that evening, and no one remembered seeing Susan or her two children. Susan backpedaled away from her story and said that she said that she had actually been driving around for hours with her two children strapped in their car seats. While Agent Caldwell was interviewing Susan, David met with the SLED investigators and told them that Susan had been dating other men. Agent Caldwell told Susan that investigators had obtained information that Susan had a boyfriend, Tom, and that Tom had broken things off with his and that Tom had broken off his relationship with Susan because of Susan's sons.
Oh boy. Here we go.
Caldwell asked Susan, did this fact play any role or have any bearing on the disappearance of your children? Susan replied that no man would make me hurt my children. They were my life.
Oh, please, Susan. You wanted Tom to be your life.
They were my life.
Oh, were. That's past tense. I didn't even catch that right away.
Later in the day, when Susan was interviewed again and was confronted about her inconsistent stories.
Yeah.
Caldwell asked Susan about her children's fussiness and asked Susan, is that why you killed them? Ooh. Susan slammed her fist on the table and said, you son of a bitch. How can you think that? I can't believe you think I did it.
That's quite a defensive reaction. I feel like if you're getting surprised.
I would have sobbed if someone came to me and I actually didn't do it. I would have been like, sobbing.
What? Yeah, I would have been. It wouldn't have been defensiveness. It'd be like disbelief. No. Like, yeah. What?
Absolutely. I probably would have blacked out.
I mean, yeah, I also probably would have been like, I can't believe you would ever think I would do something like that. It would never be like, whatever.
You son of a bitch.
Yeah, no, no.
So Agent Caldwell noted that from time to time during his interview with Susan, she would sob, but no tears would ever accompany her apparent crying. Mm. The FBI agent who administered her polygraph test on October 27th also noted that Susan had made, quote, fake sounds of crying with no tears in her eyes.
And you can't be doing that during an FBI polygraph. They make you sit really, really still. Like, the things don't work if you're, like, sobbing. So they'd have to, like, stop their process to wait for her to finish doing that.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because if you're moving around like a sobbing motion and stuff and your breathing isn't right, it'll mess up the test. So
interesting.
They probably were noting it because they're like, God damn it, we have to wait again.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So Sheriff Wells and Agent Logan contacted the FBI's behavioral science unit for assistance.
Yeah, that's a precursor to the BAU as seen in Criminal Minds. Yeah.
Okay. So Wells and Logan asked the unit to provide a profile of the characteristics of a homicidal mother.
Ooh.
The profile the FBI provided fit Susan Smith almost perfectly.
Oh.
The profile described how depression in a mother was often correlated with the blurring of boundaries. During a homicidal act, a mother may view a child as a mere extension of herself rather than a separate being. A mother's suicidal inclination may often be transformed into familial homicide. The investigation. Oh. I know. I had to include it. It doesn't really matter, but I just thought this was very interesting.
Yeah.
The investigation continued into its third day. And divers searched the bottom of John D. Long Lake, but they found nothing in the murky water. Saturday, October 29th, 1994, an edition of the Union Daily Times published a story about the discrepancies in Susan's story.
Ooh.
The story described how Mitchell Sinclair had not been expecting Susan on the night of the carjacking, that no one had seen her or her children at Walmart, that Susan had told investigators that she had been driving around aimlessly in the hours before the carjacking. Susan seemed reluctant to speak publicly in order to raise awareness of her missing children, and this caused additional speculation that Susan was somehow involved in the disappearance of her children.
Jeez.
From the start of she's so messy.
Yeah.
From the start of the case, investigators carried out meticulous planned interrogations of Susan Smith that were designed to gradually break down her defense so that she would confess.
Yeah.
The investigators believed that they could build Susan's trust in time, and they had to coax her into confessing. They were careful not to push her too hard. Investigators were familiar with Susan's previous suicide attempts, and they were concerned that if they pushed her too hard, she would just shut down.
Yeah.
Agent Caldwell. Yeah, I agree. They're probably very right. Agent Caldwell had obtained information from Tom, who had met with the investigators. He told them that Susan had reacted vindictively to his reaction and that Tom was surprised by Susan's bitterness. The investigators used Tom's information and their own observations of Susan's angry outburst when confronted with their early suspicion to develop a possible motive. That greed and ambition had pushed Susan to rid herself of her children by murdering them.
God. That's horrible.
On Thursday, November 3rd, 1994, 9 days since the carjacking and the disappearance of Michael and Alex Smith, Susan and David sat together holding hands on the Russells' living room sofa during interviews. On CBS This Morning, Susan was asked if she had any involvement in her son's disappearance.
Susan, on the news?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, okay.
Susan answered the question by saying, "I did not have anything to do with the abduction of my children."
But she didn't. Oh, that's sneaky.
Susan added that whoever did this is a sick and emotionally unstable person. Although David and Susan were legally separated, when David was asked whether he believed his wife, he replied, "Yes, I believe my wife totally."
It's kind of a self-burn, what she's saying.
Yeah. So at 12:30 p.m., Susan told her mother that she and David were going to run errands, but actually Sheriff Wells had sent for her. Susan was dressed in jeans and a hooded sweatshirt and brought with her her latest revised statement to the interrogation.
Wait, she brought a statement with her?
She's changing it is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, that's what I see.
She's bringing her new revised statement to this newest interrogation.
But it wasn't like a written statement.
No.
It was just like an up in her brain statement.
From what I can tell, it was an up in her brain statement.
Got it. Okay.
So it said now that everything it had said previously, that she was out driving around aimlessly with the kids strapped in their car seats.
Yep.
You know, that she was just doing her own thing. The only change being the road name. So she originally said that she was on Monarch Mills, but now she had changed it to Carlisle. Agent Logan asked Susan if she had anything else that she needed to add to her statement, and she said no. At 1:40 p.m., Sheriff Wells and Susan met in a small room in the family center at the First Baptist Church. Sheriff Wells confronted Susan about her story of the carjacking. Wells told Susan that he knew that Susan's story of the black carjacker was a lie. He told her she could not stop at the red light at the Monarch Mills intersection if there was no other cars on the road. Wells told Susan that she had revised her statement because of this inconsistency and that even her backup story was a lie. Wells then told Susan that he had undercover officers at the Carlisle intersection working on a drug investigation and that they did not see her alleged carjacking. So basically, when she said that she was stopped at the Monarch Mills, she also said that no one else is on the road, hence why no one saw the carjacking. But that red light wouldn't have changed if no one else was coming. It would have been green through it. Yep, it would have been green. The second story doesn't work because he had people there, detectives there, doing something totally different, but still.
But they would have noticed a carjacking, like if they're just
absolutely
hanging.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And then she said she sat in the road for a while.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Wells then told Susan that he would have to tell the news that her story of the alleged black carjacker was not true because Susan's accusations had caused tension in the union's black community.
Yeah, I bet.
After Wells told Susan this, she asked him to pray with her. At the close of the prayers, Wells said, "Lord, we know that all things will be revealed to us in time." Wells then looked at Susan and said, "Susan, it is time."
Ooh, Susan, that's a good line.
I know. Susan dropped her head and wailed. "I am so ashamed. I am so ashamed." She asked Sheriff Wells for his gun so that she could kill herself. Sheriff what?
Sorry,
Sheriff
that's Wells not funny. I'm only laughing because, like, you don't ask a cop, "Hey, can I borrow your gun to kill myself?" Like, that
also,
is just...
they're, like, in a church. I mean, yeah, I know that doesn't, like, really matter, but, like...
Susan! What?
Like, yeah, just... But, I mean, I don't know. She's not...
just irrational.
Yeah. Sheriff Wells asked Susan why she wanted to do that, and Susan replied, "You don't understand. My children are not all right." Susan told Wells about the crushing isolation she had felt while driving her Mazda along Highway 49 on the night of October 25th and the consuming desire she had to commit suicide. Susan had planned to drive her sons to her mother's house, but emotionally she felt so bad that she felt even her mother could not help her. Susan told Wells that her whole life had felt wrong and that she felt that she could not escape the loneliness, isolation, and failure that had enveloped her.
Hmm. That's really sad.
It is really sad. Like,
well, yeah, and she's been lying too. So, like, how do we know that she's actually
exactly
feeling that way? Yeah,
exactly. She told Wells about her abortion, her troubled marriage to David, and her affair with Tom Finley. She collapsed and began to sob. In her confession, Susan filled two pages with carefully written script. Susan wrote that she had driven off Highway 49 and onto the road leading to John D. Long Lake because she wanted to die by suicide. She believed that her children would be better off with her and with God than if they were left without a mother and alone.
That's so sad.
Her plan, I know, her plan was that the three of them, Susan, Michael, and Alex, would die together. Susan told the investigators that she had tried to end all of their lives by putting the car in neutral and letting it roll down the boat ramp. But she pulled on the emergency brake and stopped the car. She did this three times before she stood outside the car, overwhelmed with grief, loneliness, and pain. And she reached into the car and released the parking brake, sending the car into John D. Long Lake.
Oh, man.
After the car had rolled into the lake, Susan wanted to undo what she had done, but she could not. As she ran towards the McLeod's house, Susan planned her alibi. Susan told investigators that keeping her secret during the 9 days her sons were assumed to be kidnapped was very difficult. She said that watching her parents and David and his parents hurt her very deeply. Susan said that she was scared, but admitted that she thought she would be found out, that her story would not withstand scrutiny. Which she was right, but I think 9 days is far too long. But
9 days is a long time for that story to stand.
That's, yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
But also, it's like, it's the early 90s, you know?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, there's, yeah. They don't have the same kind of,
like, technology.
Yeah.
Sheriff Wells sent for a team of divers from the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources and sled agents to secure and search John D. Long Lake for Susan's car. Sheriff Wells wanted to tell the families about Susan's confession in person as soon as he had confirmation that the Mazda and Michael and Alex were resting at the bottom of John D. Long Lake. The first divers to arrive at John D. Long Lake were Curtis Jackson and Mike Galt. They paddled out in a small boat onto the lake, and Jackson dove into the water. His first dive yielded no results. 6 minutes into his second dive, Jackson located the underside of the upside-down Mazda. They located the Mazda in about 18 feet of water. At the place where they found the car in the lake, there was only visibility of about 12 inches.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm about to describe them finding the car. So if this is going to be, it's a trigger warning, so maybe skip like a minute ahead. Later at Susan's trial, one of the divers testified that the vehicle had the windows rolled up and all four doors were closed. He also said that he saw a small hand against the window. He said when they found the car in the water, they could see the car seats hanging upside down.
Oh my God.
Sheriff Wells flew from the lake to the Russell home to inform David Smith and Susan's parents that Michael and Alex had been found. Unfortunately, the family had already heard. So Wells told the family members and friends assembled at the home portions of what Susan had told him during her confession and confirmed Susan's account of rolling the Mazda with Michael and Alex strapped into their car seats into the lake. Wells also told them Susan had been arrested and charged with 2 counts of murder. A bail hearing would be arranged the following day at the Union County Courthouse. After a press conference, Sheriff Wells returned to John D. Long Lake to be at the scene when the Mazda was pulled from the water. It took about 45 minutes to pull the car through the mud along the bottom of the lake and into shallow water.
Oh, man.
Once the car was in shallow water, it was flipped right side up. The windshield had been cracked from the temperature changes and water pressure at the bottom of the lake. The bodies of Michael and Alex were placed in a waiting ambulance that was then driven to the University of South Carolina Medical Center in Charleston. So autopsies were performed on Friday, November 4th, and confirmed that the children had been alive when their mother sent them in her car into the lake, and they had drowned as the car submerged. In the days immediately after Susan Smith confessed, there were many newspaper editorials condemning those who were quick to believe blacks were responsible for the carjacking.
Yeah, I bet there were.
Yeah. In some of the editorials, the Smith case was compared to the 1989 case of Charles Stewart. Stewart was a Boston man who shot and killed his pregnant wife in a parked car and then called 911 and reported that he and his wife had been attacked by a black man. Stewart's 911 call was broadcast repeatedly in the days after the crime took place.
Racism. Yay.
Yeah, very cool, right?
Like, didn't we mentioned this back in February in one of our episodes that like everything comes back to racism, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, yeah, it seems like everything eventually comes back to racism. Yeah.
Yeah.
God.
So Stewart claimed that a black man robbed Stewart and his wife of their wallets and jewelry and then shot Mrs. Stewart in the head and Stewart in the stomach. During their investigation, the Boston police aggressively questioned a large number of the black men in the Roxbury neighborhood of Boston. Roxbury has a large black population. Gradually, investigators became suspicious of Stewart and his story. Stewart, fearing the truth was about to emerge, died by suicide by jumping off of a bridge.
Jeez. My God.
So Boston's black community was outraged by the treatment that the young men in their community had received during the Stewart investigation, and leaders staged rallies and demanded the resignation of several policemen and an apology from city officials. So
this was 89?
Yeah. I wish I kind of had more information, but at the same time, this is not the story we're focusing on.
Right. So yeah. I was just thinking of time period. So Susan Smith, that story was 94?
94, yep.
Okay, so in those 5 years, a lot of things happened to upset racial tensions in the country. So
right.
I can see where it didn't take maybe, I guess I don't know, I don't know how many days it took them to figure out the Charles Stewart story, but I'm surprised it took them 9 days in 94 to figure out that was not true.
Yeah, I mean, I think they had suspicions, but at the same time, it's like, whatever.
Yeah, but suspicions, you got to be able to have something to get a confession with, you know, like you have to have something.
Right. Fortunately, Union was different from Boston. The town's black ministers preached messages of healing rather than division. Wow. On Friday, November, I know.
I'm kind of impressed by that. Just
I am too.
There's such hatred everywhere.
I know. So on Friday, November 4th, the night after Susan confessed, the people of Union held a town meeting to pledge their desire for unity in the face of the Smith tragedy. More than 100 blacks and whites attended a meeting hoping to find comfort as well as send a message to the nation that Union was not bitterly divided along racial lines.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So the same day, Susan's brother Scotty apologized to the black community of Union by reading a letter to the news. In his letter, he said, "We apologize to all the black citizens of Union everywhere and hope that hope you won't believe any of the rumors that this was ever a racial issue. The night that Susan was arrested, she wrote David a letter. The letter was filled with the phrase, "I'm sorry," and complaints that Susan's feelings were getting lost in the midst of everyone else's sorrow.
Meaning that she wants it to still be about her?
Mm-hmm.
Yikes.
David was upset about the contents of the letter and thought, what kind of person is Susan? David had the same thoughts after he read Susan's confession.
I was going to say, like, I'm so sorry that you're so late on the uptake on this one, David.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean, he really, really went to battle to find them. So it shocks me that that's he didn't see.
Fair. Yeah, that's kind of my, I guess that was kind of my point. Like, what do you mean it took you this long to see that she was like this?
But also, if he's like so into finding his kids, he probably isn't paying attention to his soon-to-be ex-wife.
Fair.
Like, good he point. Thinks that they're on the same page.
Good point. Good point.
I don't actually know this. I'm just assuming. But anyways.
That would make sense that, like, if he's not paying any attention to her, which is probably also bothering her.
Oh, probably. Oh, I'm sure. So the funeral of Michael and Alex was held on Sunday, November 6th at Buffalo Methodist Church. The funeral was preceded by the visitation on Saturday, November 5th, and the casket remained closed during the visitation and the funeral.
Mm.
Michael babies. And Alex, I know, you'll have to look at our social media, the pictures of them, they're so cute.
Mm.
It's so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Michael and Alex were buried together in a white casket with gold trim during a private ceremony in the cemetery behind the Bougainville United Methodist Church. Next to the grave of Danny Smith, David's older brother and the children's uncle.
So, I've never heard of kids being buried together in the same casket like that before. Is that common?
I have no idea. I my only guess is just because they were 3 and 14 months. They were so small.
Small, yeah.
I mean, I know that you can have like children's ones, but that was just my guess is that they wanted them to be together.
Like, they left the earth together, maybe.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, but I didn't have a delicate way of saying that.
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't super delicate. I don't know if that's really what happened, but how sad all around. Oh my goodness.
I know. It's heartbreaking.
Poor babies. Yeah.
So after Susan was arrested for the murders of Michael and Alex, she was held without bail at the York County Jail. On the evening Susan was arrested, Bev and Linda Russell hired David Bruck, a Columbia, South Carolina attorney specializing in death penalty cases, to represent Susan.
Did they already know at this point that it was going to be a death penalty case?
It had not been decided, but I think they were pretty sure
it was a good chance. Yeah.
Yeah. So before beginning, I'm just going to go into him a little bit.
Yep.
Before beginning his practice, Bruck traveled throughout the United States and Canada, eventually returning to South Carolina to represent clients facing the death penalty because he was convinced that these defendants did not receive adequate legal representation.
I think that's usually true, and they think that more commonly now, too. Like, that's the Innocence Project and stuff like that. Where, like,
oh, I suppose.
Yeah, death penalty defendants often, they end up being death penalty defendants because they're with public defenders. They don't have the money to pay for, like, private defense attorneys who can petition to not have it be a death penalty case, where public defenders do great work, but they're just overworked and underpaid.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess I thought that this guy was pretty cool, but then again, he represents fucking Susan Smith, so never mind. But Brock was also...
That's a hard thing. Sorry, I keep interrupting you. That's a hard thing about defense attorneys, because sometimes defense attorneys represent defendants because they believe that they're innocent and want to help them. And sometimes they represent defendants like for the money or because they're just the best person for the job. Like, they don't always have a say in, I mean, they could just turn the case down, I guess, but they don't always have a say in like whether they believe the defendant or not. They just, a lot of times they don't even ask. They just do their job. I think of, like, Eric Rudolph. Remember his? They weren't public defenders, but they were, like, contracted to do pro bono work through can't remember now. It must have been Alabama, not Georgia. But his original defense attorneys, they said, like, we just didn't believe he should die. We were never saying that what he did was good. Like, we didn't
think
that he did a good thing. We just didn't think he should die.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Again, we're very gray with the death penalty. Well, at least I am.
Yeah, I'm pretty gray with it, too.
Brooke was also disturbed by the fact that the death penalty population in South Carolina was made up largely of poor black men. Mm-hmm. Prior to defending Susan Smith, Brooke had represented 50 people charged with capital murder before juries or at the appellate level. Of Brooke's 50 capital clients, he has only lost 3 to death sentences. He had saved many of his clients from death sentences by winning new trials that have resulted in life sentences or, in one case, an acquittal.
Wow. Okay, so he's got a good record on this.
Yeah, so like... Yeah, I just kind of wanted to throw a little bit of these in here just because I just thought that was really cool that he did that.
Yeah, good for him. It's hard.
So David Brooke hired Judith Clark, an attorney who was an expert in the death penalty cases, to assist him with Susan's trial.
Judith Clark. I feel like I
know the name.
Yeah.
In 1997, Clark would work on the defense of the Unabomber, Theodore Kaczynski. Mm-hmm. Hoping to set up a plea that would spare Kaczynski from being sentenced to death. Is that how you know her?
I think so. I feel like she's done other high-profile cases, too. But yeah, Kaczynski was quite a unique one because he was so smart that he didn't want to go along with a lot of the stuff that his attorneys wanted to do.
So the prosecutor for Susan Smith's trial was Union County Solicitor Thomas Pope, who, at the time of Susan's trial, was the youngest prosecutor in the state of South Carolina. Pope grew up in Union and attended the University of South Carolina for college and law school. Before joining the solicitor's office, Pope worked as an undercover drug agent for the State Law Enforcement Division. SLED, again. On November 18, 1994, a hearing was held before Circuit Judge John Hayes at the request of Solicitor Thomas Pope. Pope requested that Susan undergo a psychological examination by an impartial physician to determine whether she was criminally responsible for the crime she had confessed to and if she was competent to stand trial.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, me too. Because, like, to me, this lady's nuts. Like, not...
Yeah.
Should not, clearly, cannot...
Clearly mentally ill to me, but that doesn't always mean that they're not capable of standing trial.
Right, right. So she was given both the physical and psychological evaluations by the prison staff and was placed under a 24-hour suicide watch. Mm-hmm. Susan was checked every 15 minutes by a prison guard. The suicide watch continued for 8 months until Susan's trial
began.
That's insane to me.
Oh, like, my goodness. That's insane.
That's unfathomable to me because... Yeah. You know, 48 hours in those places can really do a number on you, and then be there for 8 months.
8 months, and then to have to check every 15 minutes. Like, I'm just thinking not only of Susan and how horrible that would be to be in those conditions, but also like the staffing that they would have to have in that jail while she was being held to make sure someone could check her every 15 minutes. It's pretty nuts.
So 3 weeks after Susan confessed, David visited her in jail. Susan apologized again and again for killing their sons. But when David asked her why she committed the crime, she didn't have an answer. And he honestly left feeling kind of sorry for Susan. He learned some terrible details from the crime during the time leading up to Susan's trial. One of those things David learned was that Susan seemed to have known exactly where the car had sunk in John D. Long Lake. David learned that when Susan confessed, she told the investigators exactly where to find the car. He also learned that when the car was dragged from the lake and flipped over, the lights came on. So David believed that Susan intentionally left the lights on so that she could watch the car sink out of sight.
Oh, my Lord. Okay. Yeah. That's horrible.
So a lot of this is like speculation from David's perspective. So I'm assuming none of this is proven, but he has said this.
Yeah, and he probably knew her better than...
Yeah, better than most,
you know. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's all like he learned this, but it's not in like court documents. So I'm assuming that it was never proven, but this is what he truly believes, which is, I think, valid.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a valid For someone who is in the mental state that it sounds like she was in, that does seem like a valid thing to do, to be able to watch the car go into the water.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So on January 16th, 1995, Solicitor Thomas Pope filed a notice for the intention to seek the death penalty against Susan Smith. Mm-hmm. The notice stated that the state of South Carolina would offer evidence that at Susan's trial that two aggravating circumstances existed in the murders of Michael and Alex Smith.
Okay.
The two circumstances that made Susan Smith eligible for the death penalty were the fact that she murdered two people during one act and that the murders were committed against children under the age of 11.
Mm. Fair enough on both counts.
Yeah. I was like, I don't like this. Maybe I won't include it. And I was like, no, those are actually pretty fucking valid. Yeah, okay.
Like, I never love when they're seeking the death penalty on people in general, but like, that's valid, I think.
Yeah.
If you're going by the letter of the law.
On January 27, 1995, Judge William Howard issued a gag order prohibiting the prosecutors, defense attorneys, and investigators from releasing any prejudicial information that had not been presented to the court. Okay. Judge Howard based his ruling on what he considered to be the circus-like atmosphere that television cameras had created in the O.J. Simpson trial that was ongoing in Los Angeles, as well as the pretrial publicity that this case had already received.
Yeah, for sure. That makes sense.
I didn't realize that OJ was happening in 95. I don't know when I thought it was happening, but it wasn't 95.
Yeah.
Or even before, like 93 or 94. It took a
very long time
for
that to go to trial. And the trial was also very long. So, yeah, that went on forever. Yeah, interesting. Usually, like, you hear a lot about gag orders now because
of
certain court cases that are going through, but I don't think gag orders are actually very common.
I don't think so.
It's hard age of our media, it's very difficult to do them.
Oh, absolutely. So in February, the defense hired a team of psychiatrists led by Dr. Seymour Halleck to conduct psychiatric evaluation of Susan at the Women's Correctional Facility. Mm-hmm. Halleck interviewed Susan for 15 hours over four sessions in February, March, and June. Halleck diagnosed Susan as having a dependent personality disorder and described her as a person who feels like she can't do things on her own. She constantly needs affection and becomes terrified that she'll be left alone. Halleck found that Susan was only depressed when she was alone. She almost always was in a normal mood when she was around people. In Halleck's opinion, Susan did not suffer from deep depression.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that there was such a thing as like dependent personality disorder. Maybe it's not a thing anymore, I guess.
I was going to say,
but people become that way based on their circumstances, and consider her childhood.
Yeah.
Like, why do you think she didn't want to be alone? But also, like,
absolutely,
don't kill your children.
Yeah. So before Susan's trial began, there was speculation about arguments her attorneys would use during her defense. Many expected Susan's attorneys to argue that she was a victim of destructive relationships and influences since birth. The prosecution was expected to paint Susan as a scheming monster who lied to her family, friends, hometown, and the nation for 9 days when she blamed a phantom carjacker for the disappearance of her two sons before confessing that she had drowned her children. On July 11th, 1995, after a two-day hearing, Judge Howard ruled that Susan was mentally competent to stand trial.
Yeah, I figured that was coming.
Yeah. Throughout the trial, Susan sat at the defense table quietly reading mail or playing with small objects she held in her hands. Susan wore wire-rimmed glasses, and her face generally had a sincere expression, except for when there was discussion about her sons. Then she would cry, briefly and discreetly. On the second day of trial, Pete Logan, the state law enforcement division agent who spent 24 hours interrogating Susan, testified. Logan described Susan's troubled life and her sexual relationships. Logan told the jury that Susan had sex with her estranged husband, David, on October 21st, 4 days before murdering her sons.
What?
Yeah. It was during this encounter that Susan claimed that David told her that he had taped her home telephone and he knew about the affair she was having with J. Kerry Finley.
Tapped? Tapped that her he home tapped. Telephone?
Is that not what I said?
You said taped.
Other investigators followed Logan and testified that from the beginning of the case, they were suspicious of Susan. These witnesses described a woman who cried without shedding any tears and who seemed more interested in how she looked on television than having her sons returned.
Yikes.
David Espy, the FBI agent who administered several polygraph tests with Susan, testified that Susan would make sobbing noises, but when I would look at her eyes, there was no water. There were no tears. Tom Finley testified during the second day of trial. Tom testified that he had written a letter to Susan telling her that he did not want to be in a relationship that included children. During Tom's cross-examination by David Bruck, he assisted Susan's defense by telling the jury that he thought Susan was a sweet, loving person, rather than the monster the prosecution was trying to construct. Bruck also scored points at the jury when he asked Tom about his sexual relationship with Susan. Tom testified that the pleasure she got from sex was not physical pleasure. It was just in being close, being loved. Another area that Tom may have assisted Susan was when he testified about David Smith's behavior. He testified about an incident that occurred 1 year before the murders when he had called Susan Smith one day at her home. Apparently, David Smith had hidden in the closet and, in an apparent fit of jealousy, emerged from the closet, snatched the phone from Susan, and told Tom he would hurt him if he continued to see Susan.
What now?
I don't. Do I need to repeat it or are you confused?
No, I was just, what?
So three of Susan's co-workers from Conso testified that Susan had on separate occasions told them she wondered how her life would be different if she had not gotten married and had children at such a young age.
Because
Susan had confessed to the murders of her sons, her attorneys were left with two choices for defending her.
Mm-hmm.
Her first choice was to have Susan plead not guilty by reason of insanity. The second choice was to have Susan plead guilty but mentally ill. This would require that Susan's attorney prove that she was mentally incapable of complying with the law at the time of the murders, even if she knew that her actions were wrong. The problem with the first choice is that she's not mentally ill.
She was declared to not, or to be competent to stand trial. Yeah.
Yeah. She was depressed and suicidal, but she's not insane.
Yeah.
On June 21st, 1995, the defense's most important witness, Dr. Seymour Halleck, testified.
That's the psychiatrist, right?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Halleck testified that Susan suffered from depression and suicidal thoughts in the months leading up to the October 25th murders, and that these thoughts allowed her to fall into a destructive cycle of sexual relationships in order to ease her loneliness. Halleck testified that Susan had sex with her stepfather, Beverly Russell, Tom Finley, her boyfriend at the time, with John Kerry Finley, and with her estranged husband, David Smith.
Wait.
Halleck said...
So he's saying that she not only had sex with her husband and her boyfriend, but also her stepdad and her boyfriend's dad, all in, like, the same time period?
Yep. Like, all leading up to this event.
Ugh. Okay.
Like, truly, if she's alone, she truly can't be alone.
That is just...
So icky. She's going around.
Yeah. Icky, icky. Okay.
Halleck said that Susan's sexual relationships temporarily eased her depression, but that her guilt ultimately deepened her depression. Halleck told the jury that much of her sexual activity was not for her own satisfaction. Susan was more concerned with pleasing others and making sure that they liked her. Oh, sorry. Solicitor Pope had Halleck admit that most of this information came from Susan and that her constant need for affection was a symptom of brief intermittent depressive disorder, in which Susan was able to make her coworkers and friends believe that she was fine.
That's interesting, too.
I don't know enough about this stuff. I wish I did. To me, it seems like she's a lying liar who lies, but I don't know enough about these types of things.
I don't either. Yeah. And I'm not sure that you would get the same types of diagnoses now that you would have gotten
in
94, 95 either.
Right. Yeah. Closing arguments were given Saturday, July 22nd, 1995. In a ruling that surprised and upset prosecution and the Smith family, Judge Howard ruled in favor of the defense's motion to allow the jury to consider a lesser charge of involuntary manslaughter.
Ooh, I don't love that.
No, I don't either. At 7:55 p.m., after deliberating for 2.5 hours, the jury returned a verdict of guilty on 2 counts of murder. As the verdict was read, Susan Smith bowed her head in tears and trembled.
Wait, the jury real tears? Real tears?
It just said in tears and trembled. She never trembled before. The jury appeared to have agreed with the prosecutors, who argued that Susan knew what she was doing when she released the emergency brake in her car, allowing it to roll into the lake with her sons strapped in their car seats.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. The same jury who convicted Susan Smith of murdering her 2 sons would decide whether she would die in the electric chair or receive life in prison.
Oh, damn. They were still using the electric chair in 95?
I don't know. It sounds terrifying, but I
doesn't it?
Said. Yeah.
Okay.
Fuck. I didn't even think of that. I hope I wrote that wrong.
You maybe didn't. States individually get to decide
how they do it.
Yeah. That's why, like, that recent Alabama case where they couldn't find a vein for that guy, so they did it in, like, a nitrogen gas chamber. Yeah. Horrifying.
I need to know more about that.
Okay. Sounds good.
On Tuesday, July 25th, 1995, the prosecution presented the heart of its case. David Smith testified that all his hopes, all of his dreams, everything that I had planned on for the rest of my life ended.
Oh.
Smith was dressed in a white shirt and a plaid Mickey Mouse tie, and at times he cried uncontrollably when talking about the 9 days he spent believing his sons had been abducted by the carjacker.
That's so sad. Did one of the kids get him the tie? It just sounds like a gift tie.
I don't know. I assumed it was a Father's Day present. I don't actually know that, though.
Yeah, that's what was my assumption, too.
Yeah. But no, I don't know. Smith began to cry along with at least 3 of the jurors when he said, I didn't know what to do. Everything I planned on, my life with my kids was gone. Howard called a recess as Smith tried to collect himself. As Susan Smith was escorted away to a holding cell, she called out softly, "I'm sorry, David." David Smith did not look at her. After the closing arguments were completed, Judge Howard gave Susan 1 last chance to address the jury, but she declined.
Ooh, okay.
At 4:38 p.m., the jury returned with a unanimous decision after deliberating for 2.5 hours.
Okay.
The jury rejected the prosecution's request for the sentence of death for Susan and decided instead that Susan should spend the rest of her natural life in prison.
Okay. I think I'm happier with that decision. This is just so fraught with stuff.
Yeah, like, I think she's a liar, but I also don't think she's fully... I think she needed help.
I think that she had so much trauma that I can't imagine, like, the mental illness that she was suffering from that maybe they didn't have the words to name in 94.
That's very true. So at 4:45 p.m., Judge Howard sentenced Susan Smith to 30 years to life in prison. Susan will be eligible for parole in 2025.
Okay, I was just going to ask that.
30 years in prison. Oh, at that time, Susan will be 53 years old.
That is not David very old.
David Smith felt that justice was not served because Susan was not sentenced to death. He said that he respected the jury's decision and the verdict, but did not agree with it. David also said that he would appear at Susan's parole hearings each time she might be considered for release to make sure that her life sentence means life.
If this is the most notorious case in South Carolina, I would guess she's not going to get out in her first parole hearing.
I hope not. When I was writing this, I was like, 2025, that can't be. And I was like, no, that's fucking 30. Like, in my head, I was like,
that's 30 years.
And then I did, like, I was born in 93. Yep. I am now 30. And I was like, no. Anyways, what are your final thoughts?
Man, this is so sad. Like,
yeah.
She did a horrible, horrible thing, but people whose brains are affected by trauma truly cannot always reason in the same way that people who have brains that are not affected by trauma can reason. And
right.
That was one of the first things I was thinking when you were telling me her backstory was just like, she has so much trauma in her life.
I mean, her dad, if you think about it, like, stuff happened before that in their house, but her dad died when she was six.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, there's...
It, like, truly didn't really ever get better.
No, it did not get better. And then, like, the next father figure she had was raping her.
Yeah.
Like, you can say she was a willing participant, but can you willingly consent to something like that when you are underage? Can't, like, that's a... Maybe, I don't know if it's a legal question or, like, a moral question, but, like...
Right.
Even if she was a willing participant, was her brain developed enough to make an informed decision?
Right. No, I agree. I agree 100%.
So, this is just so sad. I don't necessarily think that she should get out of prison if she has not been rehabilitated, and I truly hope she's getting mental health care in
prison.
That's
what, yeah. Like, so I didn't, this was long enough, I didn't feel like I needed to continue to do with what she's been up to. Maybe in 2025 we can just do a
do a little update
about her parole denial, basically, is what I'm gonna put into this world.
I feel like we're gonna have to, having been doing this for over a year now, we're probably gonna have to do like a couple update episodes every so often where we gather
we already have one that we need to come out with.
Yep we've got some stuff that we need to update on.
Yep. So, yeah, we'll probably stay tuned for that, guys, because we obviously know that stuff just, you know, stuff can keep happening in all these cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there are some cases that we have talked about where, like, people haven't been extradited yet or people haven't been sentenced yet. Like, there's going to be stuff that happens. And there's at least one where I got a bunch of facts wrong that I need to...
Even just what we talk about at the beginning, the 2 seconds before, or like the 2 minutes before that we just chitty chat, they're already releasing another Quiet on Set episode.
Yes,
and
they are.
By the time that's released, our episode will be out after that. So it's going to seem like we haven't seen it, but we just recorded it super early.
Yeah. And this is what happens when we're actually on top of things.
Yeah, we're in a time machine, and then we're
perpetually behind. Yeah, exactly. Life comes at you fast.
So you're okay with Susan not getting the death penalty?
I am okay with Susan not getting the death penalty because it doesn't seem like she had... This wasn't the type of intent that I would like to see if we're going to put someone to death.
So, like, I thought it was exactly what I think the prosecution was trying to... that she just got rid of her kids because of her boyfriend. And then
I don't disagree with that, but...
But as I started doing more research, I'm like, holy shit, this lady's trauma-filled.
Yes.
So even if that is the case. Also, right. I think you brought it up earlier in the episode that's like, oh yeah, all of a sudden your kids are gone, now we can be together. Like, that's not how his brain works.
That's not logical. And that's part of, like... A trauma brain doesn't have the same type of logic as a non-trauma brain. And while I'm not sure I know a single person who has a non-trauma brain, but like, I would guess that someone who grew up a little bit more privileged, like a Tom Finley, might be one of the few that has a non-trauma brain who would look at a decision like that and be like, that makes no sense.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%.
So if you had told me that she had gotten the death penalty and she was still on death row, I think I would have been quite upset with that decision by a jury, honestly.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that, like, David's saying that he's going to go to every parole hearing to make sure that she spends the rest of her natural life in prison. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with that.
Me too, especially if she is not being rehabilitated properly.
Well, I mean, if she's getting medication in prison, let's just assume, hope to God, that she's on something.
Yeah.
If she's released, she might not get that care anymore.
Correct. Because they don't, it's hard to find a job when that pays you a living wage when you are a convicted felon. And in order to, in our country, get proper health care to get medications that you might need, you need to have a job that pays you a living wage and has benefits. It's a mess.
Yeah. Nope. I agree. Anything else before I roll into sources?
I already had a lot of thoughts, honestly.
So the first one was from Fox 29. Susan Smith, nearing parole after murdering her sons, says she'd be a good stepmom. Report by Christina Coutler.
Hold on a second.
Coutler. I'm sorry. It's Coutler.
One moment, please. Did she get married in prison or something? Why would she make that statement? I'm only laughing because all of a sudden Ellie is here trying to lick my face.
No, she didn't get married.
You don't have to Google it.
This is why I think she hasn't been rehabilitated, because she still thinks that she's like, going to get released and is going to go just like marry someone and just be someone's like stepmom.
That's what I was just thinking. Like, Susan, what makes you think that you're going to get out of prison and someone's going to be like, she's the one. I would love her to take care of my children. This sounds like a great plan. I'm definitely going to prioritize her over my children, because that's what she wants. She wants to be the center of someone's world.
Also, I'm just going to say, full disclaimer, I did not find that she got married. I guess I don't actually know if she did get married.
She might not have, yeah. But Yoren did, so who knows?
So next is Go Upstate. Linda Russell, mother of Susan V. Smith, sits in the courtroom Friday prior to a competency hearing for her daughter. Her husband, Bev Russell, sits behind her. Smith trial date reset for July 10th. Judge issues gagged order in murder. Which is written by the staff writer for the Herald Journal.
That's a long headline. My goodness.
It was, yeah. Investigation discovery, the twists and turns of the infamous Susan Smith case.
Okay.
Crime Library, Susan Smith, Child Murderer or Victim, by Rachel Pergament. Pergament?
Yeah. What's up, okay. Rachel?
Sorry, Rachel. The Seattle Times, Susan Smith and the Son of the Boss, quote, The Catch Eluded Her, by Charles Sennett, and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. That's where I got the Adam Walsh history.
Yep.
And you can find that on www.missingkids.org.
Okay.
And that is it.
Good work. This was a beast of a case. Good work.
Well, I said that I was never going to do a two-parter ever again.
You did.
I'm sticking to it. But
yeah, you're sticking to it.
But that means that we recorded this in several parts over a couple days. So
yeah. Yep. Oops. While we both fended off our pets because they're like, what are you doing?
Oh, yeah. Sorry for whatever I can't cut out. We struggled through this episode. Yeah. And we hope you guys still enjoyed it. We hope you guys suffer. You guys...
What's we hope you suffer, for? Listeners.
No, what's the word I'm looking for? What I'm trying to say the opposite of suffer.
Yeah, I mean, we hope that you enjoyed the information regardless of some of our deliveries. I don't know if you could hear it, but at one point Ellie stuck her nose against the microphone and just like sniffed it.
It's going to be a fun one to edit. But seriously, I'm so happy to be out of this woman's brain. I don't ever want to go back here until we inevitably have to do an updated episode.
An update, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful end of April. I'm sad to see it go, but it means warm weather's coming.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed for us upper Midwesterners.
Yeah, well, that's true. All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening. If you're looking to see pictures of the people we covered on today's episode, you can find us on Instagram at A Most Wanted Pod. We also post true crime trivia there every Sunday. You can follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at A Most Wanted Pod. Find us and like us on Facebook at A Most Wanted Podcast. You can send us an email at amostwantedpodcast@gmail.com. Visit our website at amostwantedpodcast.com. And please remember to listen, subscribe, and love. Bye.